Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Braltz.
I'm John Steinbacher.
And
I'm Travis Tate.
Yeah, T-Dog's back in the house. Thanks for joining us, Travis.
Thank you for having me.
And we've got a fun show on the way. We'll dive a little bit into sports team chemistry and how you can actually try to measure such things. We've got a professor who's tried to do just that, Kate Bezrakova from the University at Buffalo. She'll join us in just a few minutes to talk about that. Also ahead, we'll talk a little bit about the exit of Frank DeFord from NPR. Listeners to WIOL may know that he's been doing sports commentaries for, I think it was 37 years on NPR, and finally filed his last report a week or two ago. We'll talk a little bit about that, and we'll have our rivalry this time around. I'm doing it, and yeah. I actually have one after failing
this time
miserably.
Promises, Brian. Yeah.
I have one. I really do. It'll be good. I promise. We'll talk about that as well, plus our usual status update. But as is usually the case when we have Travis with us, we're going to talk a little hoops. We're going to talk some NBA hoops in particular. The NBA playoffs are in full swing. We're in the conference semifinal round at the moment, although a couple teams have already moved on to the conference finals. Mr. Tate, what's really standing out to you about the NBA playoffs so far this year?
Well, part of that is what you have just mentioned, and that is there's two power teams essentially right now, and we've known about these teams for a few years now. That would be the Cleveland Cavaliers, who won the NBA championship last year, and the Golden State Warriors, who won it the year before. If those two meet in the NBA finals this year, as is expected, that would be the third year in a row with that matchup, and that would be the first time in NBA history where two teams have met 3 years in a row, which is kind of surprising. I would have thought that the Lakers and Celtics would have
One of our rivalries back in the day. We've certainly talked about that rivalry.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah. Philadelphia snuck in there sometimes, and I think Houston. But the rest of the playoffs, and I guess also sort of including those two teams, there's been a bunch of blowouts this playoff season. The games haven't been all too great, other than there was a really good game last night between the Houston Rockets and San Antonio Spurs. But I saw a number the other day that there were – that thus far there have been 17 playoff games that have been decided by 15 or more points. So, I mean, that's quite a few games out of all the playoff games. And I guess I was going to go off of that and maybe try to explain why there are some blowouts, at least one theory.
Hasn't this been sort of a trend for a couple of years now? I feel like I was seeing that last year or the year before, too.
Boy, I'd have to go through the game by game.
I'm probably just talking out of my something or other.
No, you've never done that before. So one of the possible explanations for the rise in blowouts, and if there were more blowouts last year, this would fit in nicely, is the prevalence of the three-point shot, which is sort of the talk of the town in the NBA world. More and more teams shoot threes. More and more players have decided to implement the three as part of their game. A really good example of that is a guy named Mark Gasol, who is an all-star with the Memphis Grizzlies. And he's in about his, I don't know, maybe his ninth or tenth year in the NBA. But this year, he just started adding a three-point shot. He had basically never really attempted too many of them in his entire career. And then this year, he was averaging 3.5 attempts per game. So he decided that, you know, this is a weapon that he needs to know how to use, and he implemented it into his game. And so, therefore, if there are more teams making and taking more threes, you know, you can see long runs of teams going on, you know, 20-0 scoring runs, and therefore winning in a blowout. So that's certainly a possibility. And there, as part of what comes along with all the additional three-point shots, many, I guess, old school basketball heads have said that they think that the three-point shot is basically a bad thing and that the game is a little too homogenized and that, you know, the offense is too simplistic and that, you know, you see players passing up layups in order to take threes. That's sort of maybe not as pleasurable to watch for some folks. So that's the general theory out there. I don't believe in it. I'm more of a believer in what produces those three-point shots is kind of a good thing to see because you see a lot more passing, a lot more cutting, and, you know, a lot more general player movement, I guess I'd call it, instead of kind of throw it down to Patrick Ewing and have him bang in the post for a while.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So am I the only person in this room that does not find professional men's basketball as compelling as the college game?
I don't watch as much of it. And I think a lot of it for me has been recently that my favorite team, the Lakers, has been lousy for a few years now. That's part of it. I'll probably tune in once we get to the conference finals a little bit more and start watching and maybe watch, you know, a few NBA finals games as well once we get there. Mm-hmm. But without my team in it, I'm keeping tabs on it.
Sure.
I'm seeing, okay, you know, San Antonio won last night. They're up in the series. But I really haven't watched much. I don't know about you, John.
Yeah, I don't watch as much as I used to. I mean, part of it is just living here, kind of inundated with college basketball over the NBA. Mm-hmm. The Bulls aren't very good. The thing I would say is when I do watch the NBA, I'm always like, oh my God, these guys are so good because I've watched so much college basketball. They're really not very good.
Well, and they're all – and they're like the best of all of the college players, right? And the best of all of the players that they've gathered from other countries. So they're the tallest. They're the biggest. They're the fastest. They're the best shooters. And so sometimes I feel like the court seems too small for them. And it gets boring. And I was going to ask you that too, Travis. I mean, because it looks like we're going to have a final with the same two teams in it 3 years in a row. And yeah, it's never happened before. And I guess we do tend to think of primacy as being like one team dominating everybody, but these are two teams dominating everybody. Does that seems, are people bored with that? Like, are they bummed that other teams can't get in? Like when there is another team that finally cracks one of these teams, it's going to be a huge deal.
Yeah, fans of teams that aren't Golden State and Cleveland certainly have a realistic expectation that, you know, in the next couple of years, they're unlikely to really advance past those teams in the NBA playoffs. The other thing is that the Cavs are very specific to LeBron James, who has sort of exerted his will over the Eastern Conference, and he's assuming he makes the NBA Finals again this year. I think it's going to be 7 or 8 years in a row where a LeBron James team has made the NBA Finals.
He's been playing basketball, it seems like, for 50 years. Like, yeah. I don't know how old he really is, but
is this
like
his 15th year? Something
he was
like
in,
that?
Yeah, but he was in the 2003 draft.
Right. Yeah. But we were hearing about him when he was like 14.
Yeah.
Or younger, maybe even. So it's just like he's been in the, you know, he was like pre-smartphones. He was well into his professional career.
Yeah.
And think of how much of the world has changed since then.
To me, that says, you know, that the – I mean, I'm an NBA just super fan, but maybe the rest of you or any other kind of sports fan, I mean, you should take the time to appreciate how good LeBron really is because he's a spectacular player to watch, but he's also a winning player, and all of his teams always win games.
But he's got a lot of charisma too. Like I like watching him play. I mean, I do watch some games. I like watching him play. I like hearing him talk, you know, in interviews or whatever, and seeing him interact with people. So you know, he's sort of like Jordan in that way, where he's just sort of the whole package. So,
as a casual fan, what I was going to say is that I'd much rather see the Cavs Warriors than some other teams. Like, you know, I don't really know much about I know
you're not a Wizards fan.
I'm not a Wizards fan. I know Boston has Isaiah Thomas, who's awesome in the fourth quarter, but you know, the Warriors won one, the Cavs won one. I think, like,
it's the rubber match,
and you got Durant on the Warriors. Now there's all kinds of, you know, as a casual fan, I'm probably going to pay attention if it's them more than anything else, but it certainly is interesting.
I will ask you, Travis, what should we be paying attention to in these other two series that are going on right now? You've got Boston and Washington. You've got Houston and San Antonio. I know that San Antonio just won Game 5 of that series. Is the Boston-Washington series tied right now?
Yeah, they're tied. I believe they're playing tonight, Game 5.
Okay.
Washington is apparently the one and only team that frightens LeBron James in the East, even more than Boston, even though Boston is the number one seed, because Washington has a superstar point guard, John Wall, and, you know, right with him, a superstar shooting guard, Bradley Beal. And so that combination of players is a little more high-end than anybody that Boston has. Although Isaiah Thomas is great, he is only 5'9", and he's kind of a disaster on the defensive side of the ball, whereas Wall and Beal with Washington are both, you know, two-way players. So that'll be interesting to see who wins there because, you know, that could determine sort of the future of how we perceive John Wall. He was a number one overall draft pick a few years ago. He went to Kentucky. He was a one of the many one and done Kentucky players, and he would be, I guess, probably the most successful of those guys if he were to make a conference finals here. So that's going to be a nice series to watch. And then, as you mentioned, San Antonio and Houston. Houston obviously shoots a ton of threes, and San Antonio has Kawhi Leonard, who's another one of these superstar wing players, and he just got injured last night. So that that series just got a little bit more interesting if he doesn't play in either Game 6 or Game 7.
So how much longer does the season go? This season goes on forever.
It's
also
another month forever, at least.
Yeah, I remember.
It goes
into
June.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember watching the Bulls back in the like mid-90s playing into June.
Yeah, it goes into June. I don't know the
it's
exact
like hockey.
Date. Yeah.
You know, hockey goes into June. It's like endless series, just endless series.
Because you've had a game and then 2 days off
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
They've always got those days off. It's not baseball
right.
where they play every day.
So. I wonder how the team's chemistry's impact that.
Hey, that's
interesting.
That's a really good question. And I think we might have to ask something about that of our next guest. Coming up, we will talk a little bit about team chemistry in sports with Kate Bezrakova. She's a professor of organization and HR at the University at Buffalo. That's coming up next on The Bandwagon.
Pleased to welcome Kate Bezrakova from an associate professor of organization and human resources at the University of Buffalo School of Management. She has studied the impact of team chemistry and how it enhances outcomes. In a general sense, I think you've done it for a lot of different jobs, but in particular, of course, we're talking about sports today. Can you just give us a little brief overview of some of the research you've done, especially pertinent to Major League Baseball teams?
We've done a study of 30 teams over 5 years, and that was Major League Baseball. We found that bad team chemistry cost teams about 3 wins on average per season. We're also doing some current work with National Basketball Association, and this sort of kind of gets to the point of team chemistry matters differently at different points. So, because often we assume that team chemistry is a good thing, you know, and it's always the same and matters the same. But what we're finding out right now that it's actually more important to the team in the beginning of the season and kind of the effects of washing out towards the playoffs. So, kind of very non-intuitive funding. I haven't done anything with hockey. But this is where there's been conversations if I should be looking at the Sabres since I'm in Buffalo, and that's our hometown team. That would be interesting. And there's been something going on with soccer, and that's sort of in my future plans, I guess.
Very good. Kate, this is Brian. I'm curious how you became interested in this particular line of research with chemistry and sports teams.
That's actually a great question, and there's a story. I am a groups and teams researcher, and that's been pretty much all my academic life. I've been looking at different teams and workplaces and organizations. And once, and it was back to 2009, so it's almost like over 8 years ago, we went to a professional conference in Japan, and a colleague of mine said, okay, let's go see a baseball game in Tokyo. I bet it's going to be an existential experience. And I'm like, well, sure, I'm all up for the new experiences. So we went to see the game, and as I was watching, it was totally existential. So, I mean, it was just it's so different cultural experience. It's just mind-blowing. And as I was watching the game, I realized this is so cool because you can really do a natural, almost natural experiment. But then one season, you can look at the specific team composition in the very beginning of the season, and you can track all the effects to the end and see the outcome. So this is like the best possible scenario that you can imagine as a researcher, right? I don't have to do all this, you know, student groups. I can just take a sports team and look at it. So I was so excited. When we got back, I said, well, let's collect the data. Let's study because it's a great team in sort of a making. That's how it all started.
Hi, Kate. This is Travis Tate. I've got a question for you, sort of about the main question that I've got, which is the chicken or the egg scenario. So does a team that has good chemistry begin to win, or does a team that is already winning develop good chemistry because of the winning?
Right. So it's kind of do they like each other enough to win, right? This is sort of something that we've been working on. And I think the way how we think about team chemistry is a little bit different from what people normally think about team chemistry, because for a lot of people, team chemistry is something fuzzy and warm and something about liking and sort of enjoying each other's company. And the way how I tend to think about it, it's not about really liking. It's about working together really well. Because in my personal experience, I can think of situations when I would truly detest someone and I would not like and almost hate someone, but I would be doing amazing work with that someone and getting a very successful project off the fit and publishing an award-winning paper. So there are some cases when you don't have to like someone to work well together. And that's probably the difference that I see in sort of an approach that we take on team chemistry. So it's more really focusing on the working relationships. And you're right. So the positive experiences matter. Maybe over time, people, even if they hate each other in the very beginning, they start enjoying each other's company. It's possible, but there are some situations when that may not even happen because I still don't like the person, but it's still he's still part of my team. So, I mean, it can go both ways.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Kate. This is Lisa. So sort of jumping off from that, where do coaches, managers, and the leaders who are actually – they're not playing the game with the players, but they're in the dugout, they're on the bench, they're there, they're part of the team, they're sort of directing the action. What role does leadership play in terms of team chemistry? I'm not talking about front office leadership so much. I'm talking about the coaches and the managers and those folks who are literally in the game with their players.
Well, leadership is important, right? I mean, I'm thinking about football, right? So you have a quarterback who is a leader. So that directs the entire strategy on the field. And, of course, coaches. The funny thing about baseball data, and this is something like you would think, right, leadership and coaches are important, right, and they're critical, and they can change the team, the way how the team goes. But the funny thing, and there's something I cannot explain, when I run the analysis with the MLB teams, I didn't really find a strong effect for the coaches. And I don't know, maybe it was part of the measurement issues that they had, because I think the way how we measure the coaches and the influence of the sort of votes, who's the best coach, it might be there's some confounding measurement. So, but I didn't really get that much of a strong effect. So, and it's sort of a puzzling to me.
I have a quick question. This is John. You've done research in Major League Baseball and then the NBA, and I was wondering, based on the size of the team, so with Major League Baseball, you're talking, you know, 25, 40 people, whereas the NBA is 12 people. Have you noticed any sort of differences in the outcomes based on size? Does that correlate to some of your work outside of sports, that the size of the team is important? I would imagine with Major League Baseball, you have probably much more likely to have cliques within cliques or whatever.
Right, right. Well, the MLB is very complex because the way it's a huge team. So what we ended up doing, and this is sort of kind of specific to baseball, you have pitchers, you have hitters, so bench players, all this sort of what I would consider a functional team within a team. And that's what we ended up doing, is we were looking at those were almost mini teams within the team, treating them as a sort of a separate entity, and then considering the team chemistry within sort of each of those mini teams. And sort of the rationale for this was that those people, those players, they spend a lot of time together practicing. They have their own coaches, so they socialize together, they go drinking together. So they have their own very distinct identities that sort of shape their behaviors. We were not able to do the sort of a similar line of thinking with the NBA, and we ended up looking at the game-level data. So basically those five players on the floor, on the field. So those five, what we call lineup data, and all our analysis are really looking at lineup and their statistics. So how they, as a lineup, how they do together, because the NBA, they recycle lineups, right? There's a little bit of a change, but still there are different lineups that sometimes, again, play together for a significant period of time. So again, they constitute a group. So it's kind of different way how they sort of cut the groups in those two different sports, if that makes sense.
Sure. This is Brian again. I'm curious how you go about trying to really quantify this data. How do you separate simply, you know, players in a given lineup maybe just being better players from them actually working better together and maybe getting more out of their abilities?
You mean the talent? Yeah, that's been a lot of sort of, we've spent a lot of thinking on talent. And, of course, you can really say team chemistry explains everything, so there's so many different factors that play into the team's success, and talent is a huge part of it. So the approach that we've taken, it's really based on the psychology behind how we as humans relate to each other. So it's really kind of the mainstream groups and teams of psychological research. So we all have different identities, and we know, for example, demographics, very important, the way how we identify being a woman, being a man, being younger, being older, being of a specific ethnicity. So it shapes the way how they relate, how they socialize, what type of socialization experiences they bring. So we were looking at those identities because there's lots of going on in the clubhouse, and players, they spend a lot of time together on the road, so that's where those demographics, their identities, their personalities, it play a lot in addition to just sure talent, right? So that also shapes and spills over during the game. That's kind of the approach that we're taking, looking at those different identities and how people form subgroups based on, because that's a great example that you sent me with the bridging different cliques of subgroups. That's ultimately the fundamental principle. And now sort of approach is look at the subgroup behavior within the teams, how people naturally form those cliques and subgroups. Because once, when we talked to NBA, and a very, very smart person, general manager, told me, Kate, like, you have to realize most of the time teams lose, and losing is very lonely. So you do really need to look at the subgroups, because that's where players go for the support. So you need to have those sort of a safe harbors. You need to have a multiple subgroups to sort of maintain the diversity of the different approaches, and because that's what brings the flexibility and the adaptability to the team. So you kind of need to have both of those things sort of kind of keep the equilibrium. So you can't really go completely homogenous and everyone's the same, so, and they all like each other because the team is going to be too rigid to win. Or you can't go, oh, they're all different, because then you're going to have a very isolated people. So you need to have sort of the middle ground.
Right. So you talk – this is Lisa. Hi. So you talk about losing and how it's lonely, or that a manager talked to you about this. Does the frequency – so baseball is a really long season. They play a lot of games, whereas in professional football, they play way fewer games. Or I'm even thinking of like professional soccer, which I follow. They don't play nearly as many games as baseball does. And so baseball teams are going to lose more games. So how does – so is that – I guess what I'm getting at is does baseball really stand out in that way in terms of cliques forming, cliques needing to be bridged because they have a longer season with more potential to lose more games?
I don't know. I think they all lose, right? There's only one champion, right? I mean, you can't really cut a difference. So most of the time, in professional sports, they all lose. So, I guess some teams, there is some fluctuation, of course, a different number of games and how they play, but they all get their fair share of losing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you a big sports fan sort of before you started to do this research, or not really? And now when you watch games, are you always sort of focused in the back of your mind about sort of chemistry and fault lines and things like that? Or can you just sit back and enjoy and watch?
Yeah, this is a great question. I don't know if I should be completely honest with you on this one. So, well, as a kid, I played a lot of sports. So I'm sort of a fan of athletics. So I can appreciate the sort of a physical part of it because I'm really... kind of the eye-hand coordination and all what goes into this. I'm truly sort of admiring all kind of the physical part and strategy part. I don't do much now, which is sort of unfortunate. And when I watch games, I normally just enjoy. So I don't really do much scientific thinking because that sort of kind of like kills the whole thing. The sort of the science part, I like the challenge. I mean, it's interesting sort of an issue. And as a groups and teams researcher, I am fascinated with sort of a kind of trying to break the new ground and trying to quantify things. Elisa sent me the link to the was the podcast, the NPR podcast, and I had blast last night listening to this because I was like, yeah, like they talk about team chemistry as being non-scientific and hard to predict. And I'm not sure I agree with this, but I do agree that just looking at what we call individual level analysis is taking one player and trying to figure out how this one player would fit into a team and what's going to happen. It doesn't really, I mean, it kind of like kills all the sort of edges and all the body of knowledge that we have on groups and teams research, because they have this literally accumulated knowledge saying when you are dealing with groups and teams, I mean, you can't really predict what's going to happen with the particular individual, because we have all this pretty cool work on, group fusion, right? In the military, we use a lot of it. They try to study terrorist groups to show how people and their identities completely dissolve when they join the team and they become a team and they're willing to sacrifice their lives for the team. I mean, the way how we behave in teams is completely different from how we behave in the individual. And they have all these decades of research in group as opposed to individual decision-making, conformity pressure, the group thing. I mean, and then on the sort of a lighter side, on the positive side, all the synergy that comes with this team, right? I mean, this is like a science. That's probably the sort of the reason why I'm using a different approach, looking at sort of a groups as sort of a kind of fundamental unity that shapes and predicts team chemistry, if that makes sense.
Sure. I think we're going to have to leave it right there, but Kate Bezrakova, Associate Professor of Organization and Human Resources from the University at Buffalo, thanks so much for talking to us today about sports and team chemistry.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we are back, and we're going to talk about sports writers. Specifically, we're going to talk about one sports writer, as we alluded to at the top of the podcast. One Frank DeFord is hanging it up, his time at NPR, which he had been doing, Sweetness and Light, I believe, his weekly column. For years, had gone down to once a month in recent months, and as of May 3rd, hung it up for good. Mm-hmm. And since my nickname for him is Grumpy McCurmudgeon Pants, you probably can get an idea of how I feel about some of his writing. So we're going to talk about Mr. DeFord. Mm-hmm. No disrespect meant, really. Everybody, please share your Frank DeFord experiences, anecdotes, his influence or whatever. But I will tell you that as a young person growing up in the late 70s and early 80s, both in the South and in Minnesota, and having a father who received Sports Illustrated every year, I read that magazine cover to cover, and I loved the long-form writing that Frank DeFord was doing at that time. I can't tell you right now because it's been a minute since then, but of like any of the specific pieces that he wrote that really made an impact on me, but it was just like, you can write about sports like this? Mm-hmm. This is amazing. And I really enjoyed it back then. Over the years, I have become less fond of his. And he still does seem to embrace this kind of crotchety old man sort of persona. And I found his commentary about soccer particularly infuriating, as I'm sure you guys, you know, will link to that piece for sure in the show notes. But I'm curious to know, how do you guys feel about Frank DeFord, or how have you felt about him over the years? I've gone up and down. How about you guys?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, similar to you, I remember reading DeFord when I was growing up, when he was writing for Sports Illustrated in the 1980s. A piece that I was a little bit too young to appreciate at the time, but I went back and have read it since then. He wrote just a brilliant long form piece on Bobby Knight, I think in about 81 or 82, shortly after his second national championship at Indiana, that I thought really captured kind of the contradiction that was Bob Knight, this demanding coach on the court, expected a near perfection from his players, but could not do the same himself off the court. This was shortly after, you know, an incident where he got into a fight with a policeman in Puerto Rico, I believe it was, during the Pan American Games, somewhere around 1979-ish, somewhere in that range. And I thought DeFord really kind of captured the contradiction that was Bob Knight very well. And then as time went on, you know, certainly he did become grumpier and, you know, kind of more set in his mm-hmm. ways. I will say that, you know, the NPR side of things, I didn't really hear very many of his commentaries because at WILL, we didn't air the part of Morning Edition where his commentaries aired. We carried Marketplace Morning Report instead, so I didn't get to hear a lot of them. I know that my mother-in-law was a big fan of his commentary. She thought that DeFord usually did a good job of kind of bringing in kind of the non-sports fan into sports and explaining things in a way that, you know, she and my father-in-law, for that matter, neither one of them are big sports fans, but they both felt that DeFord did a good job of kind of explaining things in a way that the non-fan could appreciate. And she also went and met him at a book signing a few years ago at Left Bank Books there in St. Louis, and was nice enough to get me a signed copy of his latest book, which was cool. And she said he was very pleasant, talked with them for a few minutes. You know, it wasn't just the usual sign the book, okay, right. Next. He took the time to talk to them. So I will say, though, that some of the commentaries that I saw from him over the past decade in particular did seem to become kind of more grumpy, more kind of set in his ways. And I think it was probably time for him to just ride off into the sunset, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. What about you?
I remember reading Sports Illustrated, and particularly in the early aughts when I lived in Minnesota, I enjoyed his pieces on NPR. I thought he brought it, you know, he uses, you know, very something language and beauty and splendor and that kind of stuff to sports, which is nice. Like a lot of sports writers, especially probably male sports writers, things have changed a lot over the last 50 years, and maybe he didn't keep up as well as he should have. And I know there was a big controversy about 2 years ago. He was talking about women's sports capitalizing on I think the momentum of the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, and mm-hmm. mentioned there's no league soccer league in the U.S., and there actually is a women's soccer league in the U.S.
Yes, so
like, you know, I don't think Frank DeFord 30 years ago probably would have made that same mistake. It, you know, just sort of rest on your laurels, and you know. So yeah, I agree. It's probably time to go. And it's interesting, though. I think we were talking about this off air. There's a whole lot of sports writers that I really used to admire when I was younger, who now annoy the snot out of me. And I wonder if that's because I've changed or they've changed or a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Maybe you've changed and they haven't. Yeah, I'm totally on board with the well, not on board, but it's interesting that I think that his legacy at this point is going to be anything related to soccer, at least moving forward, because the soccer fandom has been growing over the last 50 years, and it appears that he – I don't know, was unwilling to recognize that, I suppose. I would just point out, I did listen to one of those Sweetness and Lights the other day about it, that actually brought up NBA three-point shooting. So I thought that was good of him to at least basically his point was that in the past, NFL teams would quote-unquote establish the run game, and in the same way that teams kind of did that in order to do other things, basketball teams now have to establish the three-point shot in order to kind of go ahead with what they want to do. So sort of an interesting take, I guess. But, yeah, he's mostly going to be known for all of his soccer hate, I suppose.
So
maybe not hate.
I have one comment about that where it's soccer-related, but it's also American football-related. So in 2001, was it you who posted the link for us to read, him grumping about soccer, it's not our cup of tea?
Okay. Yeah.
And we had talked about that piece before. That's from 2001, and he talks there about how America doesn't import culture and, you know, it's our sports, blah, blah, blah. But in 2016, in June, so a year ago, he talks about American football and not in glowing terms. And he says, so what is football doing to us as a people? How do we explain an America that alone in the world so loves this savage sport? So in that 15-year span, he's like, we don't, you know, he doesn't say, I now love soccer. That's not like what he's, that's not any subtext here. But I think this we export culture kind of thing to him and being all proud and we don't need soccer had sort of softened it into like, hey, wait, football. You know, this is terrible. What's happening to
this? Isn't
players,
the right thing to be exporting?
Exactly.
Probably.
More or less. So, so then my question for the group here is there somebody who's going to take up the mantle of good, solid, long form sports writing? I mean, his longevity is pretty amazing. He's been around for a long time. He's come through the internet age. He's, you know, who's left? Who's around, male or female, who can do this stuff?
Guy that comes to mind for me writes for ESPN. Wright Thompson has written a lot, particularly about issues dealing with the South and culture and sports and kind of the overlap there. I think particularly with college football, just because that's such a big part of the South, like in the Southeastern Conference. He writes a lot about those topics, and I really enjoy his writing. That's one that comes to mind for me. Who else?
The name John Feinstein pops out to me. He's like Frank DeFord and like Wright, I believe. I'm not sure Wright's written a ton of books, but John Feinstein has been writing books for
30
years and years about mostly about college basketball. And so he's a name that sort of might be in the next Mick Curmudgeon pants, you know, give him 10 years.
We need curmudgeon. We got somebody's got to be a curmudgeon.
I don't really have I'm sure there's plenty of writers out there who are doing excellent sports writing that coming off the top of my head. But I do think as a trend, long form sports writing in the magazine, I think there's still going to be books, but I think people's attention spans have really decreased the amount of time people are willing to put into a lot of these articles. I think ESPN and some other outlets had made a big deal about sort of like interactive, nice-looking pictures to go with article pieces a couple years ago. But we talked to the guy at the Daily Illini who put together a really nice piece. That stuff is really still out there, but I just don't know that most people are reading it as much as they used to.
Do you think it's because we're just like a hot take society now,
oh, yeah,
where we want that hot
social media
take,
content,
or we want those documentaries, you know, like, right. Maybe a short form, a 15 minute documentary can fulfill the same, you can sort of scratch that long form sports writing itch, maybe.
And Wright Thompson, who Brian mentioned, I think he probably wrote, but he also narrated one of the 30 for 30s about, the University of Mississippi.
Yeah,
in
he went
the
to school
60s.
There.
Yeah, when they had a whole lot of racial problems that sort of overlapped with also their best ever football season there. So it was kind of like the good and the bad of 1960s Mississippi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mixed media is sort of – all those 30 for 30s are kind of a long form.
Well, yeah, and they're compelling, and like I could just watch them all day. One other sports writer whose name I just want to bring up, a woman from Texas named Jessica Luther, who's written a lot about sexual assault in professional sports. She's I think she had a book come out recently, or there is one coming. Julie DeCaro, who, you know, we've talked about here, she has written. She is a journalist. I don't know if she's done any super long form, but so there's some good female writers coming up as well.
Yeah, definitely. Christine Brennan, I think, would be probably the most prominent female sports writer right now. I believe she still writes for USA Today fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. Has a column there, and she's I think she's made some appearances here and there on NPR in different different segments as well.
Cool.
So
it sounds like Frank has hung it up, but there are others coming up behind him in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. So that's our take on Grumpy Mick Curmudgeon Pants.
Mm-hmm. See you, Frank. Thanks for all the fun.
Okay, it is rivalry time. And I actually have one this week.
I'm so excited.
And it's timely. And it's one that it's interesting. It's in intrastate rivalry. It is in professional basketball, and I think it's one where the fans probably get in each other's business quite a bit. But the two teams haven't met that often in the postseason, even though you'd think they would have, because they both had pretty good teams over the years. It's the Houston Rockets and the San Antonio Spurs who are playing right now. This is only the fourth time ever that those two teams have met in the playoffs. And Houston, prior to this, has won all three of those series, although one of them hasn't happened since 1995. Hmm. The Rockets went to the finals in two of those three seasons back in the day. One of them was, of course, when Hakeem Olajuwon was dominating, and they had Clyde Drexler on the team and all those guys.
David Robinson, the center for the Spurs at the time, got his MVP award, and then Hakeem Olajuwon with the Rockets proceeded to kick his butt, basically, over the course of that series.
Yeah, that's right. The Rockets won that series 4-2. That was the second of back-to-back titles for Houston, and the Rockets haven't been back to the NBA Finals since. Since that time, of course, the Spurs have won five NBA titles. They just had an incredible run of success, although they've been, upstaged recently by Golden State. But I was just kind of reading back through, and yeah, that series in 95, I certainly remember that series. Travis mentioned, Hakeem Olajuwon just having a dominating postseason there. And the interesting thing about that season, too, was that the Rockets really didn't have a very good regular season that year. They were like the number six seed in the playoffs that year. And the Spurs were the top seed. They had Robinson, of course. He was kind of the number one guy. But, they had a really good team top to bottom that year. And the Rockets ended up winning that in six games. And then they swept Shaq and the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals.
Yeah, the list of names that Hakeem teams beat in terms of the competing center for the other team, it's just a list of Hall of Famers. Shaq and Patrick Ewing the other year that they won the NBA title. Obviously, David Robinson. I mean, he was a killer.
Yeah, so that was that 95 series, I think, is one that a lot of people remember. The other one was way back in 1981, and again, the Spurs were the favorite. They had George Gervin. It was back in the late 70s, early 80s when they had George Gervin. And the Rockets only went 40-42 in that regular season, but they had Moses Malone, who just went nuts in that series, as did their diminutive guard, Calvin Murphy.
Mm.
And they pulled the upset, and they didn't win the title. The Celtics beat them that year, but they got all the way to the NBA Finals.
Calvin Murphy, another in a long line of media, NBA media types or sideline reporters who have crazy suits and crazy fashion. He's always wearing something sparkly
someday,
at Rockets games.
Travis, you and I are going to lead the discussion
in
the group about the sartorial side of sports. Not the uniforms, but the off-court,
you got the soccer managers can go a number of different ways. You got baseball managers who always have to wear the jersey.
Or the pullover has become prominent now.
Oh, very nice.
The pullover or the hoodie has also become
We've covered it sometimes, like when we talked about the Minnesota, the hockey hair, you know, like so the hairstyles of some of the players and also some of the coaches. I don't know. So, yeah,
I'd never heard Minnesota before.
Did you not listen to that episode? That seriously, that video is... is a wonder to behold.
Yeah, the other one, just a couple of other interesting things about this rivalry over the years that were not in the postseason. I don't know if either of you guys remember this, but Tracy McGrady was on the Rockets for a time, and it was not really a successful time in his career. I mean, McGrady was always a guy who people kind of expected more from than they really got, and injuries hurt him as well. But there was a game in 2004. The Spurs were up by 10 points with less than a minute to go, and the Rockets crowd was actually starting to boo their own team because they were losing. Tracy McGrady scored 13 points in 35 seconds, including a three-pointer with less than 2 seconds to go to give the Rockets a one-point win.
Wow.
It's incredible video. It's amazing that San Antonio screwed up that many times and McGrady kept knocking down impossible shots.
Yeah, it was great, and it kind of reminded me, it was kind of similar to when Reggie Miller just dismantled the Knicks in that playoff game, you know, 20 years ago or whatever it was.
That anniversary just happened too, didn't it?
Yeah.
Of that? Yeah.
Yeah, it did. And I have to say, I loved that. I remember when that game happened. I remember watching that live. The choke sign from Reggie Miller to Spike Lee.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that whole thing. Something similar in this Rockets Spurs rivalry. So anyway, it's not one that we probably pay a lot of attention to up here in Illinois. But the Spurs and Rockets have had a pretty good rivalry over the years, and they're renewing it in the NBA playoffs this season. So
good job.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm glad you remembered.
I'm glad I remembered, too. That would have been really embarrassing to forget twice in a row. All right, folks, it's status update time. The things that have stood out to us on social media here over the last week or two. Who's up first?
I'll start. I actually tweeted about this from the Bandwagon Twitter account, which I recommend everybody follows at Bandwagon Podcast No Vowels on Twitter. And I'm just going to read to you from this article, the lead here. Mm-hmm. Sure, you probably watched the Kentucky Derby this weekend and feel like you've gotten all of your horse watching out of your system until at least the Preakness. But I, the journalist, feel like it's my ethical responsibility to tell you about another equine competition. And if you're someone who doesn't like the treatment of horses in the races mentioned above, this might be up your alley. Introducing the Hobby Horse Championships.
Yes.
So we will link to it, but it's basically a bunch of people riding hobby horses around obstacles. The video that I have here is from Finland.
Yeah, it's equestrian hobby horses. It's pretty awesome.
The video that I tweeted, it was just a GIF or a GIF or, you know, I don't care how anybody pronounces it really anymore, but of like young people like engaging in this, and you can like hear people yelling and being really excited. So it's not, there's no... It's not like being ironic. It's
I would almost
genuinely
think that
a competition.
How would the cheering not actually distract? You know, I'd almost want a totally quiet room.
Maybe it's like coaching. I don't know. Yeah. But like I will admit I have not watched enough of this to really become an expert in hobby horse events. But
You're not an expert in hobby horse
events? No, not yet. Until I saw this a few days ago, I had never heard of it. And that's my contribution to status update, you guys.
Awesome. Who's next?
I'll go. My status update is the lack of a tweet, and this is basically my hot take of the day, which is please don't tweet at high school basketball recruits. I had noticed that the ChampagneRoom.com, which is the SB Nation site for Illinois sports, they pretty much end most of their stories about recruiting by saying, and again, as a reminder, don't tweet at recruits.
Yeah.
And that's just generally a good idea. There's been a lot of recruiting going on lately at Illinois and a lot of different ups and downs. And yeah, just say no. Just don't do it.
Always a good idea. John Steinbacher.
Yeah, I won't go too far on that, but it seems like in the Twitter sphere, the University of Illinois fans have a reputation for being extra whatever. Is that true, or is that just because?
I think so. Well, we've also had a lot of bad things happen. Yeah,
extra. Okay, so what is whatever? Like,
I mean, like really getting into. So, like, I think the most recent example is someone really went after Jeremiah Tillman after he decommitted.
So, like, we're worse than like Duke Twitter fans, or
yeah, I think to his point, like we've had a lot more sort of decommitments.
This is true.
Like that,
we've had some negative things. Yeah.
Anyway,
okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm the one who brought it up. I wanted to mention the we had talked about Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile a couple weeks ago, and then Saturday, Nike had created the perfect environment in Italy with on the road, and they were trying to beat the 2-hour marathon, and they had what, like 5 racers?
I think 4.
Three racers and a bunch of pacers.
And a bunch of pacers in and out. They did not do it, but Eliud Kipchoge, man. Anyway, you can later. Say it over me, Brian, when you're editing this.
Kipchoge.
He broke the world record, though it doesn't really count because of the conditions, because they're basically gaming the system. But he did come within 26 seconds, which is pretty impressive if you think about it. That's just a second a mile. But I guess, like, you know, they had all the pacers. They had people, like, drive out to give him
water,
food,
fluids,
and fluids. Yeah. And then, like, they even had, like, a laser on the course that to try and keep up with to make the pace.
Right. This is just the pace you need. Yeah.
So what about that is gaming the system? I mean, like, or like, what is the criteria if in order to have an official broken world record?
I think the one thing that definitely violated like the international standards was you can't have people in there pacing with you to show you the pace you need.
Got it.
And I also think the marathon, you know, it's kind of one of these things where each race is unique and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And like you're supposed to have hills and different environments. And like if you're just doing it on a perfectly flat track, I think it sort of violates the whole spirit of what the marathon is.
Oh, I agree with
about,
that. But I was just curious about in terms of like being an official world record, because every city's course is going to be different. So our course here in Illinois, very flat. Boston's or, you know, anywhere else is going to be different. So I figure there has to be some sort of baseline, right?
Yeah, and there's standards about that as far as the course. It can't have like a net loss in elevation of, you know, more than X amount. Like, so it can't be a mostly downhill course for it to count for the world record. There are certain standards there, too.
All that aside, this guy is still freaking impressive.
Fast as
he still ran
it.
He still ran the marathon more than 2 minutes faster than anybody else
That's
had.
That's incredible.
Right,
wow.
Right. And it wasn't like all of them did that. You know, the other two sort of dropped back and weren't even close. So all the credit to the man whose name I can't pronounce.
So there are a lot of, like half marathon finishing happens in that time, you know, like that's in that too. So it's just sort of crazy to think about.
Yeah, I was really happy the first time I broke 2 hours and a half marathon.
Yeah, jeez.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was looking at the pace, it's like 4:20-something or something.
It's like sprinting the whole time for 26
miles. Yeah, 26.2
miles.
I don't even think I could do that for like 100 meters.
Yeah, that would be more than enough for me. Last, not least, this just came out this morning. A tweet from Mike Evans, who is he's a trainer and youth football coach in Louisville, Kentucky, a former player for Louisville. He tweets out, "Congrats to Bunchy Young. Just got an offer from Illini Football as a 10-year-old. Fastest youth in the country." And he tagged Illinois' assistant coach Garrick McGee, the offensive coordinator. Coach McGee must be the one who offered him a scholarship.
Serious?
There are photos of this 10-year-old kid, Bunchy Young. I don't know anything else about him. I don't know anything else about the recruitment, but apparently he just received a scholarship offer as a 10-year-old.
Don't tweet at him.
Yeah, don't tweet.
I don't think Bunchy has a Twitter account yet. He was not tagged in
Bunchy.
The post.
Is it possible that was just a gimmick to distract from the fact that 2 University of Illinois football players just got arrested?
What?
Ooh. You never know. You never know. The cynical John Steinbacher.
I missed that.
Tune in to All Things Considered this afternoon. No, yeah, it just came out, I think, in the last hour. So.
Yeah, there was like...
I think arrest.
Like while we've been talking?
Armed robbery.
Yeah, it was overnight.
What? Overnight.
Just before I got in here.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's our status update for this time. And I think that's going to just about put a nice, pretty bow on this edition of The Bandwagon.
We're going to wrap it up here. So, yes, we would like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on The Bandwagon. Also would like to thank Travis Tate. Thank you, Travis, for being here.
Thanks for having me yet again.
It's been delightful. And also we would like to thank the professor, Kate Bezrikova, for her time that she spent with us today. This episode was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, John Steinbacher. And you know what, Travis? You contributed a lot to this, so
yes.
We're going to put you on here as a producer, too.
Producing credit. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, you can put that on your CV now. There are other people who have helped make Bandwagon a thing. Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, and, of course, R.E.M. from Athens, Georgia. They perform our theme music, in case you hadn't figured that out. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon. And we link to almost everything that we discuss on the podcast, videos, audio, social media accounts, blah, blah, blah. Better yet, you can subscribe to us and rate us in iTunes. It really helps people find us, and we want to be found, you know? We want to
yes.
be found. If you don't have iTunes, not a huge deal. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter, as I mentioned, at Bandwagon Podcast. All consonants, no vowels, make it easy for you, to get our most recent thoughts on stuff like hobby horse derbies and things, you know, pretty important. We also all have our own Twitter accounts, including Travis, and maybe we should just add you to that roster up there, and so people can follow you too, huh?
You're all
about the basketball?
I'm not going to be tweeting at any Illinois recruits.
Okay.
If that's what people are looking for.
If you're talking about it, that makes me suspicious that you might try to do it. So anyway, we love your questions, links, recommendations, etc. So here's the thing. So this is the last episode for a little while, and we'll be back in August. That is the plan, right? We may have a special something, something, something or other, whether it's on the podcast, or for those of you who are lucky enough to live near us, we might have something out in the world. But for now, we're going to take a break. School's out. It's summertime. We're going to regroup, and we'll be back at the beginning of the school year in August. So thanks for listening. Stay caught up. Keep following us on Twitter. We'll always be tweeting from there. And as always, thanks for playing.